Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network, a station dedicated to the concept that all manifestations of the divine are equally valid. Join Reverend Terry Power HP, Robin McKean, and all the hosts for programming covering a wide range of spiritual topics, right here on Blog Talk Radio.
A safe place where we have the freedom to think about life without judgment. We take a look at society, we examine it, and we allow for the possibility of something new, something different. And now, here's your host, Alan Ritter.
Welcome, everyone, to this April 15th show of An Emerging Forest on Spiritual Unity Radio Network. And tonight, we're joined by two guests, one here at the top of the hour and one a little while later on in the program. They have been a part of Experimental Farm Network. They are the co-founders of that network. And I'd like to introduce to everyone to Nathan Kleinman. Hi, Nate. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
Good. I always start these programs off with an introductory program, just saying, you know, how did you get started? What is your background? And we'll lead with that background into where it's taken you initially and then where it's taking you, in the moment. So why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm Nate Kleinman. I was born in Philadelphia, grew up in the suburbs of Philly. I live in New Jersey now, and I'm a farmer. Been here for 4 years now. I went to Quaker School, Abington Friends School, and then I went to Georgetown and studied foreign politics and diplomacy. I ended up getting involved in political activism soon after I graduated. I was really quite disturbed by what was happening in the world, in particular at that moment with the genocide in Darfur in Sudan. I launched into a 12-day hunger strike outside the White House, and that was kind of my introduction to activism. I got involved with a guy named Simon Deng, who was a former child slave from South Sudan, and he organized something the next year called the Sudan Freedom Walk in 2006. I did a lot of organizing with Simon over the next few years, and we're still quite close. I've done a lot of political work. I started volunteering for political campaigns when I was 10 years old, and I have ended up working on a number of campaigns. I worked on President Obama's campaign in 2008. I worked for a U.S. Senate campaign in Pennsylvania in 2010, Joe Sestak's campaign. And then I ran for office myself in 2012 for U.S. Congress in Pennsylvania. And I was involved at the time in the Occupy movement. They called me the first Occupy candidate. And then that election did not go so well. I ended up not even on the ballot after having been on it. I withdrew because I was facing a challenge to my petitions and didn't have the time or the money to address the challenge, and had been threatened by the lawyers of the other side that if I lost the case, that they would petition the judge to have me pay for their legal fees, which they're allowed to do in Pennsylvania. So I decided to be a write-in candidate and ended up not going anywhere. But about 6-8 months after that, Hurricane Sandy hit in New Jersey and New York, and a number of my friends from Occupy Wall Street started Occupy Sandy up in New York. And not very long after that, one of them called me up and said, hey, we could really use somebody to start organizing Occupy Sandy in New Jersey. And so we started having conference calls about 8 days after the storm, and we had them every night for months. And I ended up organizing Occupy Sandy New Jersey with a number of other people over the next year and a half. I spent all my time doing that. I quit the job that I had at that time for working for a union. And pretty much that was my, that was what jump-started the rest of my life. I saw firsthand that climate change and the extreme weather caused by it was going to continue to wreak havoc on people's lives, and it was especially going to hurt people who are already living on the margins and already struggling. And that's what happened in New Jersey. And I worked on storm recovery work from the southern part of New Jersey all the way to north of New York City, up along in Bergen County, where the Hackensack River flooded, where the that's a tidal river, and there were trailer parks there that were just swamped, and the entire coastline of New Jersey really was hit hard, and the communities that were poor and working class did not get the kind of resources from the government that they deserved, and they didn't get the kind of resources that I saw going to you know, fix boardwalks and to business districts. And so that was one thing that Occupy Sandy, New Jersey definitely did do, was focus our energy on those hard hit communities. So realizing that climate change is a social justice issue, that became that I started thinking, well, what can I do to really get at the root of climate change? And while I was attending a convergence on permaculture up in Quebec, actually, I was listening to a talk by a guy named Eric Tonesmeyer about perennial industrial crops, and he talked about how there's so many amazing plants out there that could be grown on a massive scale as staple crops if we put a little bit more research into them, a little bit more time and energy into focusing on getting these things up to the capability where they could really, you know, be a massive part of our agricultural system. Things like perennial wheat, perennial oil seeds, things that could replace genetically modified corn and soy. So I, having been involved at the time in Occupy Sandy, I realized that we can do a lot with volunteers, and Occupy Sandy mobilized tens of thousands of volunteers with volunteers working, you know, using the internet. And I thought, well, what if we applied the same ethos of crowdsourcing and citizen science to the problem of industrial agriculture? And I thought, well, we need to have a huge network to get people working on plant breeding projects and sustainable agriculture research. And that's how the Experimental Farm Network was born. That was 2013. And I had met Dusty, who will be on in a little bit, doing Occupy Vacant Lots through Occupy Philly. That was a spinoff group that did urban farming projects around Philly. And we decided that we would work together, and I had a large seed collection at the time, and we started figuring out what we were going to grow, trying to look for land outside the city so we could expand our operations, and started thinking about what this website, the Experimental Farm Network, would look like. And I'm really happy and proud to say that it exists now at experimentalfarmnetwork.org. And we've been farming in southern New Jersey now for the past 4 years. We're in our fifth season now. Dusty's actually, this is his first year not here of all those years. He's back in Minnesota. He'll talk more about that later. And I am really happy to be living this life as a farmer, but I'm also really fed up with what's happening in this country right now politically. So I made the decision just a few weeks ago to launch another congressional campaign here in New Jersey, because there's an open seat, and the candidate that's endorsed by the Democratic Party is way out of step with the party, for in my view. So I decided to go for it, and people can read more about that at nateforcongress.com.
Wow. So, so my in general, I look at government as being anti-fertility, because they're all about rules, and they're all about, you know, drawing, saying, oh, that plant is not allowed to function like that, or that organism isn't allowed to function like that. We must regulate how it's allowed to function. So it's interesting that someone like you, as a farmer, is looking at office and saying that's something, instead of just staying as a farmer, as being an activist as a farmer, you want to get your hands into government. Is there something there that can be repaired?
You know, I think our government is deeply flawed. I think that there are a lot of systemic problems that need to be addressed. But I also believe that it's critical that we try, because the government has so much power to do evil and to do terrible things. And unfortunately, so many of those things have been done. I think we need to turn the tide. We need to roll back so many of the different problems that government does cause, and specifically in the environmental realm and the agricultural realm, the government has been a huge problem. I will say that I think the government has done some fantastic things as well through the years. We get a lot of the seeds that we do use for our research from the USDA, which has been collecting seeds from around the world and preserving them at gene banks around the country that grow and preserve these rare varieties. And they have close to a million different plants. And without that resource, we would be in a lot worse position than we are right now. But the big problem is corporations and the nexus between corporations and the government. We have companies like Monsanto and Syngenta and huge companies that started as chemical companies and are now out there masquerading as agricultural companies, as seed companies, when really their biggest job, as they see it, as corporations, is to create seeds that they can maintain legal control of, that can be sold in concert with their chemicals that they really make their money on. So that's where, you know, they may talk about genetically modified plants being these are going to feed the world and they're going to end poverty and that's the only way we're going to feed the planet in 50 years. But that's BS. The only way we're going to feed the planet is if we get people growing organically, small scale, all across the country and all around the world. The industrial agriculture, GMOs are used, the most prominent GMOs, the most common ones that are the vast majority of all the GMOs that are on the market are things like Roundup Ready corn and soybeans that Monsanto sells, which are plants that were genetically engineered to withstand herbicide applications. And Roundup is a horrible, toxic poison that they have convinced government regulators is safe. And they have done this through lying and fraud. This is all being demonstrated. It's all coming out right now thanks to a lawsuit in California, a class action lawsuit from over 3,000 farmers who developed lymphoma. And the plants withstand the application of this herbicide. And so it's destroying ecosystems now. All the farmland is being put into it's happened already, corn and soybeans. The Roundup gets applied all over the field. The weeds get killed, but they're growing all the way to the edges of the field, so there's no more natural habitat. The insects that used to live around that thrived on some of those weeds, they're not there anymore. That affects the birds. It affects everything. And the Roundup also destroys the healthy bacteria in the soil, all of the life in that soil. And unfortunately, it doesn't affect a lot of pathogenic bacteria, things like Listeria, E. coli, botulism. Those things are proliferating. So this is a huge problem, and it exists because government has been controlled by people who are in league with these corporations, who often went from working for these corporations right into government, or who go from government right into working for these corporations. So when you have the USDA governed by people who are Monsanto lobbyists or work for these in the industry, and they believe what they're told by the corporate bosses, or maybe they don't believe it, but they go along with it anyway for cynical reasons, you end up with massive problems. And people all across the country using something that is toxic and terrible, and they think it's safe. And that's a problem of government. And if we had a government of the people who understand that they are beholden to the people and not to corporations, then things might be different. And that's a big part of why I'm running.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more cynical than that. I believe that government has always been of the rich and by the rich and for the rich. And as far as the background, sort of, you probably know all the background on Roundup. Roundup is a modified organophosphate, and the original organophosphate, it's sort of, why do they call Roundup, they call it glyphosate. They're trying to mask the fact that phosphate is in there. They say glyphosate instead of saying, oh, it's a phosphate, which some people might actually connect back to some of the earlier organophosphates like DDT, et cetera, and understand that it's a horrible poison.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And you know, I am a student of history. I totally understand what the history of this country has been. And absolutely, you're right that it has been government of the rich, government of the powerful. But it is what we have, and it has so much power. I do believe that if we can take the government from the rich and powerful, then we might have a chance. We might have a fighting chance. And climate change is such an urgent problem. I believe that without concerted action from the government, there's very little that all the rest of us can do just outside of government. And, you know, I recognize that I'm a long shot in this campaign, and I'm going to continue fighting whether or not I'm inside government. I believe that issues like corporate power in the USDA and so many other critical issues have to get out there. And my campaign, I talk about a number of things besides the environment and climate change and agriculture. social justice is at the core of my campaign, and I believe that we absolutely must fight against white supremacy, against patriarchy, transphobia, homophobia, and bigotry of all kinds. I believe we've got to end mass incarceration and fight police brutality and corruption. We've got to stand up for women's rights, for LGBTQ rights. We need universal health care. I believe we need a universal basic income. We've got to end the war on drugs. We've got to treat immigrants fairly and refugees. We've got to fight sex trafficking and sexual abuse and violence, domestic violence and child abuse. There's so many different issues that the government has a real central role in. And unfortunately, the current government is doing all the wrong things. So I really believe that the more we get people talking about this, the better things can be in the future. And if people don't discuss the problems and hear about these problems and hear about possible solutions, they're not going to have their minds open to that. And unfortunately, the way the public discourse goes in this country in this age of Trump, politics is the big story right now. And Trump sucks up all the oxygen in the room, but you know, we've seen in the past when there have been interesting campaigns in the past year and a half that the press will cover those. So I'm a late entry into this campaign, but I'm running because I believe that we need to something needs to shake up this race in particular, but the entire narrative on the Democratic Party right now. It's become, you know, a corporate party, if it, you know, perhaps it always was one, but we need to have real progressive candidates standing up and fighting for what's right. Otherwise, we're not going to get anything done. And unfortunately, the current candidate who the Democrats support here in South Jersey is a guy named Jeff Van Drew. He's a state senator, and he's considered the most conservative Democrat in the Democratic Legislative Caucus. He gets a 100% rating from the NRA for his consistent opposition to gun control. He's taken money from the NRA, and he actually lied to a group of high school students about it quite recently and was confronted the next day on camera by one of them. He voted against gay marriage as recently as 2012. He wants to bring back the death penalty. He's opposed raising the minimum wage. He wants to take New Jersey out of the regional climate change consortium. And he doesn't even have an issues page on his website. He doesn't stand behind these things that that are in his terrible voting record. And yet, because there's currently a Republican who's retiring from this seat, the powers that be believe that that this guy has the best chance of winning. But I think that kind of cynical politicking really is one of the biggest problems with the Democratic Party. They don't recognize that this is a truly swing district where people will vote for the person and not the party. And in fact, the current Republican, I've heard many people say they think that he is more progressive than this conservative Democrat who the party bosses want to replace him. Frank Lobiondo, the retiring Republican, is considered an environmentalist, and he's pro-gay rights, and he's got a pro-union record and a lot of support from union people. So it's a really strange race that this is what's happened here. But I think that if people hear about this race, if they realize that there is an alternative, and that they don't have to just follow along with what the party bosses say, that they can nominate a real progressive, and we can have a real chance of winning this seat, so that when the Democrats take over Congress in November, they do it with people who are actual Democrats. And I really do believe that even somebody who is as progressive as I am can win this district. This is not Donald Trump may have won the district. He won it by less than 5 points. But 4 years earlier, Barack Obama won it by more than 8 points, and he won it 4 years before that, too. So This is a real swing district, and it's considered one of the most likely to swing to the Democrats. So this primary is critical. The person who wins this primary is likely to win this seat in November, and I'm hoping that it's going to be me.
So a few minutes ago, you said you were a long shot, and now you changed your language a little bit. So which are you?
Well, I would say I say I'm a long shot because Van Drew has got the support of the party establishment. He's going to have the endorsement of all the local county parties, so he'll have the best
right.
position on the ballot. He's going to have the most money behind him, and he's going to have, you know, he's going to have ads on TV distorting his record, and you know, if he thinks that I'm enough of a threat, distorting mine. So there's no doubt that I am, you know, that this is going to be an uphill climb, but I do believe that if I can get the word out, if this race becomes a story, and if people across the district learn that I'm running, then they're going to vote for me. So, you know, by its nature, it is a long shot. I don't have a lot of time. The primary is on June 5th, and my name was just certified on the ballot last Thursday, so I have less than 2 months to run this campaign. But I think that because I'm a farmer and I'm going to be out there farming and working, and if the press wants to interview me, they're going to have to come find me on the field a lot of the time. It's not like I'm going to be able to go to every event in the district. This is going to have to be a media-driven campaign. There are hundreds of thousands of people in this district. There's no way that I'm going to be able to shake hands with all of them in the next 2 months. But we've seen, you know, that's maybe the one thing that I can admire in Donald Trump is that he ran a very non-traditional campaign and managed to win.
So I was thinking that if you wanted to, I mean, the only way to grab the attention is, as you said, to have it be a media-driven campaign, and to do something to get that would be media-worthy. And I'm sure from your activist days, you could think of a million. You have. Just enunciated the issues, so you would be able to do something that would be media worthy, and that that would have to be covered in such a way to get your name out there and to get the issue discussed with the curve that you wanted to put on it. That would, I mean, if it is going to be a race that you would probably not do well in, at least you would get the issue out there and get people aware of it.
Absolutely. I'm going to be it's going to be an interesting campaign. I'm not going to tip my hand yet, but I will. I hope you'll and all your listeners will be paying attention and keeping an eye out, because this is there's not a lot of time to get the attention of a lot of people.
Yep. Well, everyone, we're going to take the bottom of the hour break right now, and we'll come back and we'll talk about more focused talk on the Experimental Farm Network in the rest of the show. So hang on and we'll be right back.
To wear the horn was the crest when you were born. Your father wore it, and your father wore it too. And hero, Highland Joe, Jolly Rumble.
International Pagan Radio. You can hear your favorite artists such as Dave the Bard, Tuatha Dea, Spiral Rhythm, S.J. Tucker, Murphy's Midnight Rounders, and many, many more. Join us for exciting shows like Ask a Witch and Storytime with Rook as well. www.internationalpaganradio.com on the net or on TuneIn Radio on your mobile devices. Join us on Facebook and Twitter too. International Pagan Radio, all pagan, all the time.
Welcome back to an emerging forest on the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. We hope everyone was able to stretch their legs and get a drink. And now, back to Alan.
Welcome back, everyone, and let's launch into the second half of this really awesome show by talking about the Experimental Farm Network. And take it away, Nathan.
All right. Well, thanks very much again. Really happy to be here. So the Experimental Farm Network is the nonprofit that Dusty Hinz and I started in 2013. And the idea, again, was to create a platform to facilitate collaboration on sustainable agriculture projects, especially plant breeding projects, to develop plants for climate change mitigation, staple crops that can be used to help sequester carbon in the ground, excess carbon from the atmosphere. Plants are the best, most natural tool that we have at our disposal to do that. You know, you hear about all of these ridiculous geoengineering projects people talk about to fight climate change that are going to have all kinds of unintended consequences. When we know that we have at our disposal through a regenerative agriculture system to actually sequester the excess carbon from the atmosphere that we need, we might even be able to take out enough to stop global warming. It sounds far-fetched, but combined with some common sense things as far as conservation and reduction of emissions, we could use our agricultural system as a powerful tool to fight climate change. So, you know, I knew for a long time about efforts to develop perennial wheat through the years. People have been working on it for over 100 years, and a lot of them have gotten really far, and they've developed some perennial grain crops. Some of them existed 50 years ago, but the seeds were lost because the funding was lost and the research stopped, and people thought that it was never going to be as lucrative as annual wheat, so they stopped working on it. But people are interested in it again, and organizations like the Land Institute in Kansas have been working to domesticate a wheatgrass, which is a wheat relative, and they've created this grain they call Kernza that's being used now already to make alcoholic drinks and certain other things there's bakers experimenting with using it in bread, and lots of farmers are starting to grow the stuff. It's got a much smaller seed than wheat, but it is viable, and it's a start. It's the first thing that the Land Institute has introduced in the decades that they've been around. But they're working on perennial sunflowers as a temperate perennial oilseed crop. There is a perennial oilseed out there that is that unfortunately is causing huge problems, and that's palm oil, because there's massive deforestation happening to create these palm oil plantations. But you can see that something that is a plant that lives year after year and produces a crop year after year, you don't have to till the soil, you don't have to replant, actually can have some immense value. But there are way more sustainable ways than palm oil that we could be doing it, and we need to do a lot more research and a lot more development of sustainable crops, especially for our temperate climate up here in the north, so that we're not growing corn and soy with massive chemical inputs and constant tilling of the soil. On EFN, the idea is we have a website that anybody can join. Anybody can post a project on there that is looking for volunteers. And then anybody else can create a profile and volunteer for one of those projects. The first project that's up there right now, the first one that we put up there, is a perennial grain sorghum project that I put up there. Sorghum is a really amazing plant. It's a staple crop in parts of Africa and India. It's a gluten-free grain. It has many varieties have a stalk that is full of sweet sap and can be pressed to squeeze out juice and boiled down to make molasses. The grain is higher protein than corn. The plant requires just 1/7 the water of corn, and it grows in marginal land. It needs much less fertility in the soil to get a good crop. A lot of farmers use it as a cover crop, and crosses with Sudan grass, which is a wild sorghum relative, grown with legumes like cowpeas. Sorghum makes a really fantastic cover crop, and tilled into the soil, the sugars in that stalk are wonderful for the microorganisms. They love feeding on that stuff, so it's a plant that a lot of farmers are already familiar with. A lot of people already grow it. It's actually the fourth most common grain grown in the United States. It's grown for animal feed primarily and bird seed. But perennial sorghum, a temperate perennial sorghum, is already a reality. These things have been developed, but they have not been commercialized yet. We're working with an experimental strain that we got from folks in Oregon a few years ago, and we now have one single plant that survived our New Jersey winter last winter, where our fingers are crossed that we're going to see it sprouting within a few weeks here for having survived its second winter. But of course, we save seeds from that surviving plant, and we have a whole bunch more that we're going to be planting this year from that surviving plant so that we can do work on improving it and finding ones that that have better agronomic capabilities, that are bigger seeds, easier to thresh, things like that. So we're really, really excited about that, and it's going to be a fun project. So we have that project listed up on the website, and anybody can call in, and jump on the website, create a profile, join that project, and we'll send you some of those seeds. And you know, plant breeding is really finding a needle in a haystack often. So it's something that the more people you have looking, the more chances you have of finding that needle.
So what are some of the other projects that you have, or some of the other projects that maybe someone just put up there themselves, sort of external to Dusty and yourself?
Sure. So some of the other projects that we've put up there include a chinkapin chestnut project. That's a native species of chestnut that has a much smaller seed than the common domesticated forms of chestnut. But it's a native species that is a lot more resistant to the blight that killed most of the American chestnuts. It's native in the southeast as far north as southern New Jersey and central New Jersey. So we're really excited about that one. It's really delicious. It's a nut that you can actually eat raw, a chestnut that you can eat raw. It's quite tasty. We have a project up about jojoba, which is a desert plant from the southwest, and it actually is that's one of these oil seeds that could replace petroleum, but it is just not grown at nearly the quantity, there hasn't been enough research done, there hasn't been enough breeding work done to improve the crop. It was originally touted in the 70s as a replacement for sperm whale head oil, which was a major industrial product used for all kinds of things, from candles to, you know, grease in machines. But that's something that grows in, it's native to the Sonoran Desert to the southwest. It is a perennial plant, a big bush. It actually thrives in drought years. Quite a few of the plants are frost resistant, so it can handle a light frost 3 days in a row. With this changing climate, even places that don't historically get that kind of weather are going to be facing that. That's one of the big problems with climate change. We have a project up there about May apples, which are a native woodland plant. They grow in the shade on forest floors, damp forest floors, and that's a really cool plant. It's got a really delicious fruit, but it's particularly interesting because every other part of the plant, except for the flesh of the ripe fruit, has a toxin in it called podophyllin toxin. That was one of the first chemotherapy agents, and it is still used as cancer medicine. But that podophyllin is often harvested from plants in the wild in Asia that are relatives of the North American May apple. So if we can breed May apples that have a higher podophyllin content, it would take a lot of the pressure off of those wild populations in Asia. And it would also, you know, because it's a really interesting and delicious fruit, is another plant that could be grown. And it grows on forest floors, so it's taking up land that's not otherwise taken up, that's not being used for other forms of agriculture. Some of the other projects we have up there, we have a few rice projects that other people put up, and Dusty has been managing those on the site. We have he can talk a little bit more about those. We have a perennial kale breeding project that somebody in Oregon, a really amazing plant breeder named Chris Homanix, put up there. That's an awesome project. It has some of the it's the most diverse collection of perennial kale germplasm that's ever been put together, and it's really it's really beautiful. People can check it out and see that it's
Mark, you have a beer.
They can see how they can see that it's got really beautiful diversity there. And there are a couple of other cool projects up there. There's one for Yamberry. That's a Dioscorea. It's like a yam is not like a sweet potato. But it is also a tuberous plant, and it looks awfully like a sweet potato. But most yams are tropical, native to Africa, and there are other yams in other parts of the world that produce these aerial tubers that are also edible, like small potatoes in the air. And Eric Tonesmeyer, who I mentioned earlier, and who was one of the people who inspired this this whole project, actually posted that project up there. So right now we have, I believe, 15 projects up, and we're really excited to get more.
So I'll bring Dusty into the broadcast at this point. Hi, Dusty. How are you this evening?
Hey, good. How you doing? Sorry, I'm on Central Time. I totally got mixed up here.
you made it just in time. So why don't you talk
here.
About? I mean, Nate already talked about his background. Why don't you talk about your background for a few minutes?
Yeah, my background is I grew up in a suburb of the Twin Cities, and I went to Augsburg, and I got into urban farming 1 year in Minneapolis before I moved to Philly, and I moved to Philly with an ex-partner. I really kind of got into it was to begin with urban farming, and now it's, you know, now I've got into like larger scale stuff in like rural areas. But really, I got into farming from very much like a political, social perspective. I just felt like it was a very tangible, practical way for people to try to like gain more autonomy over their day to day lives. And so I moved. I was in Minneapolis for one growing season, moved to Philly, and that was kind of like coinciding with the Occupy movement. I actually moved to Philly 5 days after Occupy Philly started. And really, I don't think I'd be probably sitting here talking to you right now if it wasn't for Occupy. Like, everything kind of like flowed from there for me. Because I was new in Philly, and I kind of like just met a whole bunch of people, kind of fell in with like the radical gardener niche crew. And one thing led to the next. I met Nate through that. And then we branched after a couple of years of doing some urban farming stuff and guerrilla gardening in Philadelphia. I branched out with Nate down to South Jersey, where we farmed for 4 years and co-founded the Experimental Farm Network. And we started this small seed selling operation. And I actually, just a couple months ago, moved back to Minnesota to Badger Set Research Farm, which is a hazelnut, chestnut, pecan-focused farm. And I could explain more about that. But that's kind of, in a nutshell, my story.
So that's a very interesting pun you just made there with moving back to hazelnut, chestnut, and pecan farm, and encapsulating that by saying that's your story in a nutshell.
Exactly.
We're not talking about eggs. We're talking about nuts. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about what you're doing in Minnesota?
Sure. So I had always kind of imagined coming back to Minnesota. It's where I'm from. So I am inheriting some land here, and I don't exactly know what's going to kind of happen with that. And I'm not at that land now. But I had known about Badgerset Farm and Philip Rudder and the work that he's doing for, like, quite some time. And then I kind of on a whim tried to reach out to them to see if I could come volunteer a couple years ago. I happened to be back in Minnesota for, like, 10 days, and I had, like, 10 free days open. And I was able to come here, meet Philip, meet Mark, the in-house, like, the main worker guy here, and I came back in, that was during the harvest season of 2016. And I came back in January for a couple of meetings where I solidified organizing like this work. I called it a work for education exchange. And that was something that I organized this past summer. I got a group of 10 people to come here. And I was still living in Jersey back in the summer, but I came here for a month to Minnesota in the summer. And the idea was we were going to, like, we plant a bunch of trees and do on-farm work here. Philip gave lectures and stuff. So it was kind of like a work for education trade or something, because so oftentimes these permaculture design certificates and other things out there, I feel like can be very, like, cost prohibitive for a lot of people. And anyways, it was a kind of like a cool opportunity to try to organize something that was, like, really valuable and useful, and, like, people got to learn directly from this guy who's been breeding these things and, you know, working with these tree crops for 35 years, and get to do it, and actually get to do, and actually one of the critiques I hear of these PDCs oftentimes is they're not hands-on enough. People are just getting, like, talked to or whatever. So people were able to learn here and do tangible, real, like, on-farm agroforestry work, and learn while doing it, and it was, like, super affordable. So that went pretty well in the summer, and I had kind of been thinking, this was even before this happened in the summer, but I had been thinking, hey, I kind of want to move back to Minnesota and move to this farm. So over the course of the rest of the summer and the fall, I kind of solidified, like, a kind of a business type arrangement with Philip, and then early January made the move back here to Minnesota. I was out by my parents for a few months, but now I am down here at the farm. And here at Badgerset, I'm still going to be growing annuals. I like to grow annuals. We sell a lot of annual seed, and so definitely still doing that. And they've given me this little plot of land where I can, like, grow on, and that Nate was nice enough to let me use the BCS, not use it, take it with me, our small, like, walk-behind tractor. I took that with me back here to Minnesota so I can kind of, like, go on to a new, fresh patch of land and just do what I have to do on a small scale with that. I also, Mark and I here at the farm are working on coppicing hazelnut. Coppice is when you cut hazel or any tree to the ground and let it grow back up from the roots. And what you're left with when you coppice hazelnut bushes are beautiful, long, straight, hard, skinny branches or stems, rather. And these are, I'm trying to, and I've actually already started making some sales. I have some ads on Craigslist. I'm trying to sell these as, like, bamboo of the north and try to sell it to, like, gardeners and folks for building trellises with. At least that's one of the initial things that I'm trying to sell it as. So, so here at Badgerset, the plan is to learn a whole bunch, grow annuals, try to market wood products like from coppice, like hazelnut steaks. But there's also coppice that needs to be done of chestnut, and you can make biochar or chestnut charcoal with that. And then planning to try to help out here with harvest, being a part of harvest, trying to get pecan and chestnut to market. And just kind of diving into just, in some cases, whatever needs to be done. They have Icelandic sheep here, helping out with that, maybe learning a thing or two here and there with Icelandic sheep and horses. And also first time living off the grid, really. Although, I guess me and Nate did live off the grid one summer at the farm in Jersey. We kind of, like, did that a little bit. But this is kind of, like, a going to be, like, for real, living in a tiny house. I mean, we have to fetch water from the greenhouse, any electricity, some solar panels. And that is the – so that's the situation here.
Sounds very exciting.
It is definitely going to be a wild ride. I think it was the right time to head out of Philly. It was great. Like, I absolutely love Philadelphia and South Jersey and the people that I met there. It was an awesome experience there, but I kind of felt like it was time to move on to, like, a new chapter to explore, like, a new place and learn new things, keep life interesting.
Wow. So we're very close to an hour, and so I think that we've covered most of what we wanted to cover, and that's really awesome. So, Nate, do you have any things that you want to say, and then I'll circle back amongst all of us to get everybody's contact information. But I think this is a really well-timed first introductory show. We can certainly do follow-up shows, more in-depth shows about particular content. That is certainly welcome. But I think as an overview show and as an introduction to the two of you and to EFN, this is a really good first show. So go ahead, Nate.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm really, really happy we were able to do it. I would just say I really would urge anybody who's interested in what we're doing to check out our website. Again, that's www.experimentalfarmnetwork.org. You can check out our seed store website as well, which is the word store, S-T-O-R-E, .experimentalfarmnetwork.org. Actually, I believe I got EFNseeds.com working as well. It took a little while to get them linked up. But, yeah, you can go to EFNseeds.com, and that will automatically redirect you to the website. It's easier to remember. We've got some really awesome seeds on that site, and all of the sales go to support the nonprofit. So we really hope that folks will buy some seeds. It's not too late to plant most of the seeds we have on here. It's getting a little bit late for the tomatoes in a lot of the country and the peppers and the eggplants, but for, you know, things like lettuce, kale, squash, sorghum, okra, legumes, there's all sorts of things that people could still order and plant. And Dusty's brother will get the seeds out to you as fast as possible. So would love it if people check that out. And please, folks who are interested, do check out my campaign website at nateforcongress.com, NateForCongress.com.
So, Dusty, do you want to give ways folks that can get in touch with you and talk a little bit more about the organization Badger Set Farm?
Sure. I'll start with just talking about Badger Set, I guess, and you can close with the contact info. Well, really, Badger Set is the brainchild of Philip Rutter. He completed his coursework for a PhD in biology. Mark was just talking in the background. Genetics, evolution, and ecology is what Philip Rutter has a PhD in. He actually didn't complete a thesis, but he like took all the coursework. And he moved down here to see. He went to the University of Minnesota. He moved down to southern Minnesota and purchased this farm in the early 70s. And really, first thing he did was he looked at the, well, not maybe the first thing he did, but one of the first things he did is he looked into the soil survey. And like post, like just after World War II, compared with how the land was in the early 70s, after 30 years of annual corn and soy agriculture, this farm had lost over 20 inches of topsoil. We're in the driftless region, and the soil here is, like, super silty and soft and will just, like, melt away. And it's also very, like, it's a – the driftless region, which comprises, like a, it comprises southeastern Minnesota, northeastern Iowa, and then a little bit of northwestern Illinois, and then a chunk of, like, southwestern Wisconsin. So it's this region where – the glaciers never hit. So it's like very hilly and like, it's like bluff country. And so this farm, he came here and it's like, you know, he was kind of looking at it like, hey, this is like essentially like suicidal. This is like so wrong-headed that we would just be doing this corn and soy agriculture and literally melting away like this precious topsoil, like into the Mississippi River. And so he's like, basically, some, you know, proven alternative needs to try to be, like, you know, needs to try to be achieved or to be discovered and researched and just, like, so he's been plugging away for 35 years trying to breed hazelnut, chestnut, and to a lesser extent, they're a hybrid pecan. He's also growing those here as well, but the lion's share of the focus has been on hazelnut, and then also chestnut. And the idea of these tree crops is basically, hey, let's do perennial agroforestry where we don't have to till the soil every year, and you know, no chemicals are sprayed here. So he's breeding these tree crops to exist in essentially like quasi wild system. Insect populations here thrive, and they get great nut harvest. And yeah, actually, interestingly enough, Philip is also very much like critical of just like permaculture, like as like just some like little, he sees it as just like some little like boutique, like backyard, suburban type edible landscaping thing. Oh, it's like, oh yeah, but what is being done to change corn and soy fields to like something else? So, like the big picture, like the big scale, like, what could be done to stop corn and soy and do this like alternative thing that would actually be like a good thing that could still produce important human calories. I'll dive in a little bit more about the hazelnuts and just briefly, like they have maybe the best chance to possibly just become like some type of perennial staple food crop that was brought to scale maybe in something like the Midwest here. Like, they're 60 to 70% oil, and we could have, like, the olive oil of the North that would be in every grocery across the Midwest. And if it was brought to scale with the proper harvesting machinery, processing. So that's kind of been Philip's whole – that's been his whole vision, and that's been what he's been working towards. He had developed his own term that he uses called woody agriculture. And he's very much been in the business of trying to like create a serious, viable alternative that he's mainly been trying to like, he's less concerned about, you know, suburban permaculture people or something like that or whatever. He's been trying to like prove a model to existing corn and soy farmers, That's basically what the vision has been here. Chestnut, you can make, like, if it was produced on a larger scale, you can make like cornmeal or flour with it, and is like very much like nutritional and healthy. Both these things, hazelnut and chestnut are also pack a punch with like the just like the vital like human calories that they would like offer up as like an alternative. To corn and soy. So, I came here to this operation here also needs help, and it's like I came here to come here, help out, collaborate, learn, and try to, you know, push this envelope of perennial, you know, Midwest agroforestry staple food crops. And so, you know, that's basically, I'm still going to be doing annuals and everything, but I kind of wanted to come here because it was kind of pushing towards that, just that bigger, like, paradigm shifting type action. So that is basically, you know, what's happening here. People can find me on Facebook if they want, Dusty Hinz, that's D-U-S-T-Y space H-I-N-Z. That's maybe the best place to find me. I'll continue being on Facebook and whatnot. And that pretty much is all I have to say.
Well, thank you. Thank you both so much for being on the show. And thank you, everyone out there in the audience and those who listen in the future. This has been a really informative show. My name is Alan Ritter. I'm the host of An Emerging Forest. I run a small produce club in the Philadelphia region. It's serving West Philadelphia at present and southern New Jersey using sourcing wholesale commercial agriculture products, fruits and veggies, supplying them to folks at large discounts compared to standard groceries like Whole Foods or Wegmans. If you want to get in touch with me, my email address is RITTER.ALAN88@gmail.com, or you can go to produceclub.us if you're in the service area, and that will take you to a Facebook page to join the club. Thank you, Dusty, and thank you, Nate, for being on the show.
Thank you, Alan.
Keep up the good work.
And everyone out there, have a great week, and see y'all soon. If I don't put the closure.
Thanks for listening to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. Join us 7 nights a week for exciting programming covering a variety of expressions of faith. And remember, all manifestations of the divine are equally valid.